Tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes, swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Here we are on the chilly second Wednesday of the month. It must be time for the dirt bag. Indeed it is. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. Here with me is my guest Jim Gilbert of One Green World Nursery. Full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Glenn.
Well, the weather is our topic at hand here. How's it out there in Southtown?
In our little frost pocket. Actually, not too bad. 25 this morning. I noticed up here it's right now about 37. So,
yeah, we were below freezing. We had frozen water.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we did, but not so bad. I was expecting worse. So,
what's the wind situation?
We don't have any wind this morning.
Yeah.
And that's why it's colder.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yesterday, though, it was interesting because of 2 miles east of us, the temperature was 32 degrees, and we were 42 degrees, 2 miles.
Huh.
It was just a breeze. We had a slight breeze, and they didn't have.
Mm-hmm. I think, what did we get up to? Portland got up to 47, 48 yesterday, and Eugene was 58.
Wow.
Well, that gorge has a big impact on us.
Well, I'm really glad this wasn't one of those Arctic frost things.
For us.
For us, yeah.
Boy, it is in some parts of these United States.
I've been trying to ignore that.
Okay, I won't bring it up then. Okay, as usual, we have a packed show. We've got olives as the plant of the month, my wife said. Olives, that's kind of an unusual plant of the month. And it may be, but Jim will explain why it's not.
Well, right, and one of the compelling reasons is that this is when they ripen.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've got the garden stumper at half past the hour, and we'll also be talking more about the cold weather, of course. And then also something that I've been doing in my garden is, as it's too late to plant a cover crop, I've been getting beds ready now for the winter. But what it really does is I'm getting them ready for planting in the spring. Really, as soon as it warms up, all I have to do is plant. There's not much else that I would need to do. So we'll talk about that. Not too many events going on, eh, Jim?
It's kind of, we're in a little event desert right now. But well, they'll start again January.
That's right.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, maybe I'll have more of this later on, but we'll probably have, once again, the beekeeping issue or edition of the dirt bag next month. It seems like December is a good time for that, as there's not much happening in the garden. But talk to Jim about that. All right, olives. Oh, I should mention, too, if you have any gardening questions, feel free to give us a ring, 503-231-8187. Any kind of gardening question you have, we'd be happy to tackle that this morning.
Please call.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's lonely out there in the country. I don't want to talk to people.
Oh, Jim. You're playing the pity card here.
Well, I'm not lonely for olives. This year is a really amazing crop. I'm rather shocked to see how many olives we have on our our plants. What I want to do this year is to experiment with different ways of processing them. I've only done one way in the past. And so, as many people know, although some people may not know, you can't just pick an olive off a tree and eat it. You have to process it to get the bitterness out. And the methods of doing that vary and create different kinds of olives. So one interesting fact is that black olives that you purchase in the store didn't start out black. They started out green, and the processing is what makes them black.
Can I just ask a little question here? Sure. Do all olives, you know, that end up black olives, do they start out as basically one type of olive, or
there are lots of different kinds.
Yeah.
Huge variety. You know,
let me rephrase that. Sure. Can any type of olive end up as a black olive?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm by no means an expert on olives, although I am learning.
Yes.
And in Oregon, I would love to talk to any experts that exist about olive processing, because it does make it, all those different olives we see, many of them are different varieties, and the processing is quite different. The first method I tried using years ago was basically a simple water bath method that my Ukrainian friends told me about. In southern Ukraine, where they take the olives, put them in a jar, fill the jar with water, change the water every day for 30 days. And
that's all.
And that leaches out the bitterness. And then you put a salt water brine in and put it in the refrigerator for a week or two, and you've got some really tasty olives.
You don't need to flavor them or anything.
You don't need
to. Pickles or something like that.
You can. And then there's salt curing, and there's different ways, which I can't go into too much detail because I haven't done them yet. So perhaps in a month or two, I'll be able to speak more clearly about all those. But we have so many this year that it's pretty exciting to be able to try some different methods. One of the other exciting things is we have different varieties that have produced fruit. And a few years ago, we brought back some varieties from southern Ukraine that I thought had some promise, but I didn't know because, you know, in Oregon, we don't have any olive orchards, or at least we haven't had any.
I believe there are some.
There's some.
Some experimental type acreage.
None of these Ukrainian varieties have been planted anywhere except in our little spot. So this year we have some fruit from them, and I'm pleased with their size, and some are ripening fairly early. It's interesting that some of the green olives, some are more green, some have sort of a purple cast to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about that. And the other thing about the black olives is that when they turn black on the plant, they're not usually so good for eating fresh. That's when they use them for oil. And I have a photograph in our catalog, I believe, that shows a black olive. Actually, I took the picture in March in McMinnville when the fruit was on the plant and fully ripe. And like I said, you take that and you'd squeeze it for the oil.
Do the plants, the fruit, have to ripen completely on the vine, on the plant?
Well, ripeness is another issue that I had to do some research on. And when the juice of the olive goes from clear to a milky color, that's when it's considered to be ripe and ready to be able to be processed.
Does that happen only on the plant?
That's a good question. They fall off the plant. I mean, green olives will fall off of olive trees. And you know, I'm always amazed when I'm in California and the ground is littered with olives and nobody's picking them up. They're still green on the ground. So they obviously do fall off. But I don't know about the ripening actually of fruit off the plant itself.
So for planting these olives, what type of a situation does it require? I mean, sun?
Yeah, they want full sun or at least half-day sun, the warmest location probably possible one can find in our climate.
Given that tomatoes will run for their money here, for the space anyway.
Yeah, and you know, in Portland, I'm always amazed in this sort of city environment how a lot of plants, fruit will ripen. It ripens earlier because you get more heat than we do. So that the fact that we have ripe olives in our location is, this year has been a very warm year.
Yes.
Very nice year.
Right.
But I'm very happy with that. But generally speaking, a good warm location, olives are evergreen. They're very attractive trees, and I think in an environment, they are wind pollinated. And many, there are varieties that are self-pollinating, self-fertile, although I think that you'll get better success if you plant two. And if you're going to plant two, you might as well plant two varieties.
Yeah.
But you can plant two, for example, Arbequina, which is self-fertile, and they'll just get more pollen moving around. An olive orchard, of course, is a lot of olive trees. So if you plant one tree, it's probably a good idea. In fact, I'd say it's a good idea to, when they're in bloom, rub your hands around in the tree if you want to take a brush and move some pollen around. To get the pollen from flower to flower is important because the bees aren't doing it. It's just done by wind.
Is it not attractive to bees?
Apparently not.
Well, I might have to research that one.
Yeah, there's lots of pollen. I mean, it's real obvious when they're in bloom.
You see any insects out and about?
I've never seen an insect on an olive tree doing anything with the flowers. But generally pretty easy to grow. I mean, the main danger is cold. They're tough plants otherwise, and we've discovered pretty reliably that the olives, that most of the olives that we have, Arbequina, for example, is hardy somewhere between 8 to 10 degrees. And we've had a few winters recently that have given us that information. For example, the last winter, which at our place got down to 5 degrees, that's when olives are frozen to the ground and then start over again from the base, which a number of ours have done that.
Okay.
That's a lot of olive info right there for passionate olive eaters out there that might want to grow a few of their own.
Well, it's tempting. How big do the plants get? That's a space is always an issue in the city, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, if you're going to go to California, you can see some pretty good-sized olive trees. I mean, I expect they're probably 15-foot tall ones.
These are trees, not
they're trees,
bushes,
right?
Yeah.
But they're not fast-growing particularly, and I would say they're pretty darn easy to keep. In our climate, you'd keep them to 8 to 10 feet without any trouble at all.
All right. Anything else on olives that we need to know about? I guess you can report back to us how those olives are, or maybe even bring in a few samples for us.
That would be fun, wouldn't it? Yeah, we should do that. I'll work on that next time. I can have some samples of olives. I think it's not the kind of crop that, you know, people should go out and plant probably 1,000 trees. Although some have done it, and they're having some success with it, from what I understand. But it is the winters can be the big challenge.
Yeah.
With them. Other than that, I think they're fun to grow.
Okay. Our plant of the month, olives. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
We'll take a break and come back and talk about cold weather and things that we might want to think about doing for our plants now or for the next cold snap. I've got to set up this tune here that we're going to listen to, which is a Etta James. She's the artist on this. She didn't write it. I think Wilson Pickett and Steve Cropper or something like that did. But this is in line with our olives. This is Miss Pit Eiffel. Miss Olive Pits, yeah. Miss Pit Eiffel. All right, Etta James here. Miss Pitiful, in honor of our plant of the month, olives. Well, this cold weather is not, while it was not unexpected, it's certainly unseasonable, as the weather forecasts will say. But what bothers me is they talk about, well, normally it would be this warm or cold this time. Well, that's not normal. It's averages that we're talking about here. We never have normal weather. We have average. We just average what it's been before and after, and that's what we, right. So very rarely, I think, is it right on the money of whatever. But in any event, this is colder, and this wind is certainly out of the ordinary for the Portland metro area. On my bike ride in today, I saw, well, in my neighborhood, there was a big branch that came down on a fence, about maybe a foot in diameter. And then I saw another tree that had just roots and all had gone over. But it wasn't a large tree, small to medium, maybe 10 inches in diameter or so. A birch, I believe. And there was some power lines that I had to maneuver around. I mean, the PGE truck was there, but I asked him, could I go over that? Yeah, you should be okay.
Let us know.
We wanted somebody to see if that was live or not.
Yeah, right. So. Well, it's unusual to have strong east winds here. I mean, it happens, but this is normally our strong winds will come out of the southwest, and I suspect some plants are probably not ready for a wind from the east.
Yes, and this is a little early. You know, most things haven't gone into full dormancy yet.
Right.
But it's not really cold either.
No. So. It's generally a good. I mean, this is an okay freeze to get things to go into dormancy. Mm-hmm. And for us, as in our nursery, we sort of want to have a little freeze to knock the leaves off the plants. Then we can dig them easier.
So, yeah, a lot of leaves are coming off.
Yeah,
I tell you that.
Yeah, but I'd say overall, I mean, this is nothing unusual. I mean, 25 degrees is not even that temperature. We've had. I remember when my youngest daughter was born on November. She was born on the 3rd of November. On November 11th, 1985, it was 14 degrees in our place. And we were heating with wood, and it was definitely a little baby, and trying to keep the house warm was challenging. So it can be a lot colder.
Yeah.
In early November.
Well, one of the tasks that I did yesterday was ran over with a power lawnmower many leaves. I mean, I mowed a lawn in the meantime, but there were a lot of leaves on the lawn, and it was just collecting leaves is the way I looked at it. And I think I must have emptied the grass catcher or leaf catcher in this case maybe 20 times or so. I mean, sometimes you couldn't go more than 3 or 4 feet and it would fill up the bag. There were so many leaves. It was like drifts of snow. You know, they were, I suppose, 8 to 10 inches in some places, the leaves, and just go slowly and then fill up. But it was great. I used them a lot to put on beds that still have broccoli growing in them. I just put them around there, mm-hmm. thinking, well, hopefully that the broccoli will prevent them from blowing away.
Sure.
So that was one use.
And they're pretty shredded by that.
Yes,
too, right?
And I really like it. I like it that way. The soil likes it that way, or the mm-hmm. worms and other organisms mm-hmm. Will like that there too.
Yeah.
Did you take any precautions of wrapping up plants or anything like that?
Well, we always take these forecasts seriously. I advise everybody when they've become much more accurate. When they talk about temperatures dropping into the mid-20s, it's not super dangerous, but potted plants, I think we always make sure that our container plants are someplace we can protect them, at least minimally. The biggest danger, and listeners who have potted plants outdoors should pay close attention to the forecast, because if it starts dropping in a little lower into the teens and it's going to stay cold, the biggest danger to those plants is the soil freezing, the whole mm-hmm. pot freezing, mm-hmm. because the roots aren't hardy like the top. And we've learned this lesson, painful lesson, numerous times. You know, protect those, keep those pots warm and above freezing if possible, or not too much below, because it'll really kill the roots.
The smaller the pot, the more vulnerable.
Yes, the more quickly vulnerable too.
Yeah,
yeah. And if you have a pot sitting on the ground, it will get some heat from the soil, just enough. That will help. If you have it sitting on a deck or patio, then that's much more dangerous, because there's no insulation at all, no heat at all coming from the soil. I mean, it's interesting. In our climate, we rarely get frozen soil more than an inch or two deep. I mean, that's really unusual, if anything deeper than that. If you go other parts of the world or even the United States, you can get 3 feet, 6 feet deep.
Right.
And so we're pretty lucky that way.
That's another way.
Yes, yes. I don't tell a lot of people about it. I'm glad we're on a local radio station, not broadcasting to the Midwest.
Well, you never know who's listening where.
Well, that's true.
Well, let me remind our listeners that if you have gardening questions that you'd like to run by Jim or me, please give us a call, 503-231-8187. I did a somewhat of an experiment. You know, we talk about pruning trees in the summer, fruit trees in the summer, which is what I try to do. Mm-hmm. Try, see, that's the key word here.
Right.
And did many of them, but I have some in some neighboring properties that I take care of. And gosh darn, I just wasn't able to get around to them until the first week of October. And I've pruned them pretty late before, even in, you know, towards the end of September. I think this is the latest I've gone. And I'm thinking of replacing these apple trees anyway with something a little more to my liking. And we'll see. They always produce.
Yeah.
And even with that late pruning.
Yeah, you're almost to the point where you're doing winter pruning.
Yeah. I mean, they're almost dormant.
Right. So the effects are probably going to be, you know, you'll get some good growth, some new vigorous growth from those.
Yeah, I don't know if that's good or bad. You want to keep them small. And,
yeah.
And that's the idea of the summer pruning.
Right.
When do you start pruning, speaking of dormant pruning?
Well, you know, we have so much to do, we can't really put it off for long. I mean, I suspect once we get through with our, we're trying to finish up some fall work, and then we'll probably start pruning in December.
It's not too early. Well, I would think it'd be a little, it's not too early.
I don't think so. No, we never had any adverse effects from pruning in December. The only thing I would caution is, and we've learned this, that there are certain plants that it's best to prune in the spring. Peaches, for example, you know, other, especially prunus, because they can suffer more from disease problems over a long wet winter. So we typically will wait until March, just before growth starts. So because we want to prune them and have them heal over that pruning cut quickly.
Right, because if you did it when it was dormant, then it doesn't heal, so water can bring in
all sorts of organisms.
Yeah, and fungal problems.
Bad guys and stuff. So, yeah, so that's our one, we were very, very careful not to prune those until later. But apples and pears and so forth, we prune them in middle.
Okay, before we go to the phones here, give us the group prunus. What else would be in that?
Cherries, plums, apricots if you have them.
Nectarines,
almonds.
Okay.
Although almonds don't usually need a lot of pruning, but they would be in that same family.
Well, I'll try to remember to talk about this more, but just last week I was at the Oregon State Beekeepers Conference, 3-day affair, and a lot of talk of almonds.
Really?
There, because there's a lot of pollination there.
Taking the almonds, the bees
to almonds,
mm-hmm. Bees to the almonds, right?
That's right.
In California, right?
Right.
We're working on bringing the almonds to Oregon.
Okay, Tammy, let's see what's on our dirt baggers' minds. Good morning, Rick. You're with the dirt bag.
Yeah, I had a question about cold weather coming in.
Okay.
I have like some plants like kale and chard and different types that are in pots. I was just thinking maybe is it a good idea to just take and plant them and just plant them right now, like pull them out of the pots and put them in the ground?
Well, Jim's nodding yes.
I'm not so much an expert on vegetables, but it seems to me that they'd be happier in the ground than in a pot.
Yeah. Was there a reason, Rick, why you had them in the pot? I mean, one reason would be why you don't have the space to put them in the ground.
Yeah, that's part of it. I could make more space in the garden, and for a while I had them on the fence, but then I just put them on the ground.
Uh-huh. Well, one idea, if you do want them to remain a little mobile, so to speak, is just to dig a hole and put the whole pot in the ground. It doesn't have to come out of the pot.
Yeah, I've done that in the past. That's probably, I might plant some of them like that, and some of them I would just put right back in the ground.
Well, they're very hardy, both kale and chard. I expect all of that to remain viable through what we've experienced so far.
You know what the temperature is today?
The high temperature?
Yeah.
I think it's around close to 40.
Okay.
And the lows, I think, are going to be around 30 again. But you know, that's not, that's not, I mean, that's fine. I mean, you just don't want those roots to freeze, as Jim mentioned. So just digging a hole or even heeling it in, as we say, just, this is what I sometimes do with my potted plants, is just throw mulch around them. Put them on the ground and mound up mulch around them.
I think I'm going to put them in the ground. I got a shovel and just put them in there.
You'd be the safest that way.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. And I'll think about it later.
You know. Right.
All that stuff's going to be
three in the morning.
And
yeah.
Wind's going to play hell with that.
Yeah, it'll really, it can dry out leaves. There's just that so much wind. So that's a good option.
Thanks. I'm going to do that today.
Okay. Bon appetit.
All right.
You'll be enjoying those things for the months to come.
I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Bye.
Thanks, Rick. Uh-huh. Yeah, we had chard. My wife and I had chard last night for Din. We harvested all the peppers before this hit, and I started preparing those beds, and just dozens of peppers. Red, yellow,
great.
Orange. I don't know if we had any orange ones, but green. Very colorful. And we had some sautéed onions and peppers last night.
Mm.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
Almost lunchtime, isn't it?
Well, thanks to you, no. But okay, Tammy, who do we have? Good morning, Alan.
Hi.
Go for it.
I don't want to keep you from lunch. It sounds pretty good. But I had a question about hoogles.
Okay.
And hopefully you haven't talked about those already, because I came in partway through. But we got talked into – we live in Salem at about 900-foot elevation – and we got talked into putting in a hoogel mound by my son. And this may not have been the best summer because everything grew perfectly, but we were amazed at how we've never had tomatoes here that have been any good. And this year we had a bumper crop, and we had melons, and we actually put an olive tree in kind of at the corner end of the hoogel as well. We'll see how it does. But
well, before you go on, Alan, let's define hoogel here. Jim has got this quizzical look on his
head. Yeah, this is a new word to me.
This is a type of compost. It's a composting technique.
Right.
And
basically biomass.
Yeah, oftentimes with a lot of woody debris. That's
right. So what we did is we dug a 17-foot by 6-foot wide, 2-foot deep trench, and we kind of live on a slope that looks south. So we put in a bunch of rotting logs, which we have tons of.
Uh-huh.
And then we put sticks and needles and branches and then covered it all over with compost.
With finished compost?
Right. Potting soil compost that we just had dumped.
You mean you bought this from
We bought compost soil from the local compost soil guy.
All right.
And it just had like a yard or two dumped.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up with about a 6-foot-high mound. Looks like a burial mound.
Mm-hmm.
Like we got some quizzical looks from the neighbors.
Yes.
At first. And then, we have raised beds. We have other things. But we put some stuff in that we've really never tried before, like melons and peppers and tomatoes. And the advantage, at least in theory, is over the years, is this compost, it puts out heat. So it's about 2 or 3 degrees warmer than the soil would be otherwise, and it's sort of a sponge for water, so we shouldn't have to do very much watering next summer at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have to. So anyway, I don't know if you have any experience with that, but I'm a firm believer on after the first year. That's
right. Well, you know, you can't make any blanket statements, you know, like for your tomatoes after 1 year. Could have just been the year, and in fact this was
right.
a very kick-ass tomato year, at least in my experience.
No, you're right.
And, you know, because it was pretty dry and we had warm nights. You know, that's what makes it, that's tomatoes like that. So you said you had other raised beds?
Yeah, and it's, the truth be told, tomatoes weren't quite as good on the raised bed. Let's see, what do we have in both places? I mean, what we had.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
We had beans. We had some melons and squash. Of course, squash grows wherever you throw it, really.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's my bias that things got a little warmer and they were just happier.
Yeah. Well, raised beds is good because, you know, that little extra heat is good, particularly in the beginning.
And this is the ultimate raised bed. And it's actually kind of easier to work on, too, because you just kind of reach out and there it is. There's your food.
6 feet tall, really?
Yeah.
Did you need ladders to get up there to garden? Or?
Well, we didn't have that. And in retrospect, particularly for the sort of the watermelons and the cantaloupes, it would have been easier to have some sort of structure to get up and over. So that's what we're going to do right next year.
And how do you spell the name of this bed?
Oh, it's H-U-G-E-L, which means mound in German. Because I think the Germans figured it out.
Yeah, it's a way to get rid of a lot of stuff. You know, they were probably just burying their stuff and then figured out, gosh, our things grow pretty well on that.
Well, when we heard that some lady in Seattle was growing avocado trees with great avocados on her hoogle, that's when we decided we got to try this.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah, I'm a little leery of that, but.
Well, yeah, but keep it in mind. It's another thought. It's,
yeah.
It's certainly a great way to get rid of your rotting wood.
You know, and this could be perfect timing for this suggestion, Alan, with all this blowdown that we've got here. A lot of people are going to have a lot of stuff to get rid of.
That down here, but it sounds like a lot of your gardeners up there would love to have a place to put their stuff. So anyway, another thought.
Well, thank you very much, and call us next year to see how your garden does next year, too.
Good point.
On your mound.
Especially your olive.
Yeah.
I'll let you know.
All right. Thank you. Good gardening to you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Okay, we'll stay on the phones, Jim. Victoria.
Hi. Hello.
Go for it.
Yes. I planted 12 asparagus plants, the roots, this spring, and I mounded them, and then I've just been, they grew beautifully, except for an area where the trees shaded them more than I liked. Yesterday I put a bunch of compost over the roots, and I was wondering how deep should I pile that compost around the actual stems of the asparagus that have grown up and are all furry.
Well, you can cut down those now. They're dormant.
Oh, I can. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Because everything I read said leave the plants growing.
Well, they may have been meaning don't harvest the edible shoots when they're real small.
Oh, okay.
But then they go bigger and then they gather information. Did I say information? Energy and whatnot so they can grow bigger still. But they're not doing that now and they'll just, they're dead.
Oh, because one of them still had a shoot.
I had a couple of shoots coming out. I noticed that yesterday too.
Yeah. So I did pile compost around them about 4 inches all around where I felt that the roots were.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can cut those now. That's wonderful to know.
Yeah. Sometimes I cut them a little high, you know, if you have 4 inches of compost, which is a good amount.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can go 6 inches even if you wanted. I leave them, you know, an inch or two above so I know where they were.
Oh, well, I've got them planted all along a hurricane fence just because I've tied them up because where I live there's quite a bit of wind.
Uh-huh.
And so that's great. Any other instructions or ideas about them that I should know about next spring?
No, that's really what we do to get them through the winter or for overwintering is just mound up compost or rotted manure.
Great.
If you had access to manure, that would be good too. It'd be a little nitrogen, a little more nitrogen than the compost.
Oh, well,
but
what I did is I put feather meal and lime as well as rotted compost.
Perfect. That's a source of nitrogen.
Yeah.
Underneath the compost, it'll be ready to roll in the spring because that's one of our first crops, vegetable crops that we can eat.
I'm looking so much forward to it. I read somewhere that per person you should have 6 asparagus plants.
Yeah, that's about right.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
We love our asparagus at this household.
Yeah. It's great because you can just gorge on it for 2 months, then you get sick of it, but then you don't get it for another 10 months. So.
Well, I understand in our growing area, which I'm in the North Willamette Valley area, I can get two crops.
Yeah, it just keeps going.
Right.
But at some point, you want to let them go so they can.
Yes. Probably what, mid-summer?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Or some of them go anyway.
Right. Also, the growth pattern. Now, I mounded the soil when I planted them because we have this real heavy clay where I live. And and it's a grade, and the water runs down. I was curious as to which way they're going to grow. I mean, do they stay clumped, or do they start spreading?
They start spreading.
So I was hoping they would spread on the downhill side.
Well, just pull out the ones that are on, or dig out the ones that are on the north or the uphill side, and plant them downhill.
Oh, I can do that.
So yeah, you're starting over again, you know, but you have your roots there, so.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. So let's say I see a new sprout come up, I harvest it for eating, and then after that, can I chop that off and move it so it's going to the downhill side?
Well, if you can try it. If you've harvested it, then that root is not going to have much way to gather energy to replenish itself for the following year.
Okay, so basically, once you harvest, you've killed off that rootlet.
Well, no, because a root will have more than one stalk.
Oh.
I mean, it's just kind of one plant.
Yeah, I noticed.
Kind of. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well,
all right.
You know, as my motto is it's all an experiment.
That's right. Well, every year it is when you're a farmer.
Right. Well, I live on a hazelnut farm, so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Experimenting is good. We strongly believe in that.
Yes.
We always try to do something. If we're trying something new, we try to keep the old and do the new and then see which works.
That's great. You know, that's the way to do it.
Well, yes, with experimentation and knowledge, you know, a lot of times it's knowledge. And, you know, us adventurous ones, we experiment, but we remember the old.
Right. Very good.
All right. Well, thanks. I love you guys' show.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Uh-huh, bye.
Bye.
Shanti is on the line now. Good morning.
I have a plum tree that's 45 years old, about, or maybe more. And so I just heard you saying about the prunus, that the plum tree would be in the prunus family.
Yes.
Yes.
What you're talking about. And so that means if I want to keep it small, which I do when it's smaller than it is, the thing to do would be to prune it in the spring? Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, early spring would be good. I mean, it's, you know, I would say early March probably.
It's still cold.
Cool, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely still dormant. That's the idea. But just before it starts to grow, that way there's less exposure to all the winter weather and diseases and stuff that come along with it.
Let me ask you this question, Jim. When I recommend trying to get a out of control tree back into control, you know, in other words, shortening it, or obvious most of the time, I say do it over 3 years, and when it's dormant, not when it's not summer pruning.
Mm-hmm.
And would that hold true with the plum?
Yeah, same.
Do it when it's dormant. These we're making big structural cuts.
Right.
You know, things, branches that are over 3 or 4 inches.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's going to be danger there, of course.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And what we found an interesting method of that prevents some problems with that. Take Dreft. Did I tell you about this?
Yes, you did.
Yeah. And you mix it, I believe, I'm trying to remember now, it's something like probably about 50% Dreft, 50% water. And after you make that large pruning cut, take a brush and paint some of that on there.
And Dreft is a product.
Yes, it's a baby detergent for, you know, baby clothes.
Oh, I hadn't remembered that.
Yeah. Well, you probably don't wash too many baby clothes, nor do I.
None.
But
right.
But they discovered that in California in the vineyards.
How did they discover that, do you figure?
You know, that's a really good question.
Well, let's just park the baby here on this cut
right.
stump here.
And we'll wash their clothes.
While we're picking plums.
Pour that old dishwater or that baby water, wash water over those trees and see what happens.
Well, somebody's grandma told a young person to use the
laundry detergent from their baby.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know how they did it.
Around but... since I was a kid, which is, you know, the World War II.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, back to your plum here. Yeah. So if you are making, let me ask this question. When you say it's 45 plus years old and you want to, I can't remember what the words you use, but you want to shorten it. Is that right?
I want it smaller.
Smaller.
And shorter so I can, so I don't, so most of the fruit is closer to me rather than having to use a huge ladder.
Well, so what I recommend is a 3-year program here. And
okay.
So to, and cut off 1/3 every year of those structural limbs that you determine that need to be removed.
And so then all the smaller limbs, the structural you're saying is 3 inches?
Well, no, anything that's larger than 2 or 3 inches.
Yeah.
That would be more of a structural cut.
Okay.
And then the regular pruning for the fruit-bearing branches, the smaller limbs, in early March. So maybe in January for the structural cuts, and then paint on the 50% drift and 50% water. Maybe you could spray it on. Spray bottle?
If it's a small, if it's one tree, painting, it's going to probably
be easier.
But, you know, spraying would work too, sure.
And then the smaller cuts in March.
Well, drift is a powder. It's a solid.
Oh, it is.
No,
Jim says
not the kind we buy.
It's a liquid?
It comes in a liquid and bottle. Yeah.
All right, so they're making it in liquid now. Good.
Yeah. Oh, so you've heard of drift before, eh?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I used it to clean my baby clothes 40 years ago.
Oh, well,
and my baby
I learn something every day. Every hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I told, you know, I told my children and goddaughters about it, too. So, but I didn't know that that's liquid now. Doesn't matter. I can still make it 50 and paint it on. So, do the bigger branches at 2 inches.
Or bigger, yeah.
Bigger in January.
Mm-hmm. Find a nice day.
Yeah.
Nicer.
I can. I'd love it. And then in March, before it starts to flower.
Yes.
At least before the buds start to get on, right?
Well, in Portland, they're probably going to be coming on in March.
Yeah, they'll start to swell.
So, yeah, the swelling.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, I've pruned peaches and nectarines when the buds are, I can tell what's a leaf bud and what's a flower bud.
Yep.
And with no ill effects. And in fact, I kind of like that because then I know the rule of thumb kind of for peaches anyway, and nectarines is to take out about, 2/3 of the new growth to spur new growth because that's where the fruit's going to be. If that's what the way I approach it.
Okay. So. Well, I haven't become intimate enough with the branches on this fabulous plum. I've just been eating tons and tons and tons of plums for a bunch of years, 20 or more years. But now I need to become more intimate with it. I don't know the difference between a budding, a swelling, where the leaf is going to plop out of that.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter too much.
Where the food is.
Just cut a third of it off every year.
Okay.
Just some of those branches, just cut a third of it off or 2/3 of it off on some of them. Leave other ones full.
You will notice if you look at a branch that there's going to be at the tip of the branch, there will be buds that are pretty tight and close to the stem. And then if you go back, you'll see probably the point where it started to grow the last year or this past year. And there'll be a clear point. And then below that, there will be buds that will be more sticking out, more at a right angle from the branch, pointed buds. And those will be the flower buds.
Oh, yeah, of course it would be. That's right. Well, I guess as you're talking about it, I know that I have looked at the branches wondering when in the world am I supposed to help this tree from getting so much lichen by making it smaller?
Don't worry about the lichen. That's a sign of healthy air. It's not a parasite, so
oh,
it's just
well,
hanging
you.
On
I didn't
there
know
and
that either.
Getting its nutrients from the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just
right.
An old man tree.
Yeah, on older trees, it's there. I mean, because it has a chance to get attached to that wood that's not really growing very fast, the older wood.
Just like you have to your plum tree. You've got attached to it.
Yes. Yes, All right. Definitely attached. Oh, this is fabulous learning. I'm going to copy it out. I'm going to get it because KBOO has this fabulous technology of being able to listen to this program again.
I'm going to copy
it out and learn it and do it. And this year is going to be a great turning point for my yard and my plums that I can share with everyone.
All right.
Well, we're excited about your excitement.
I'm excited.
Very good.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, you bet. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Another caller, Jim. Janine.
Hi. I was wondering if this would be a good time to transplant a young plum tree.
It could be. In fact, I should say yes. not even qualify it. The plant by now, they've gone into dormancy, and there may still be some leaves on, which should come off quite easily. And other than that, it's fine. In fact, it's a good time to do it.
How big is it? Janine? Uh-oh. Janine, you'll have to listen on the air then. So if it's probably just a, she said a young, is that what she said?
She said young, yeah. So I was presuming a just 2-year-old, 3-year-old tree, that wouldn't be a...
Probably a little sapling, half inch in diameter. Maybe a little bit larger than that.
Yeah, I mean, you could do a 1-inch diameter.
It doesn't matter. It's just easy, more... So bare root, try to get as much wood, dirt with the soil with the root ball? Okay, she's back. So we don't have to guess now.
Missed anything that was said.
Okay, so it's how old is it?
I planted it in the spring of 2013.
No problem at all. Because you're only transplanting one tree and you're not worrying so much about trying to have a whole bunch of them like we do sometimes when we're digging hundreds, the more soil you can leave on that root system when you dig it up, the better, and the tree will go through less shock when you transplant it.
Okay, so I shouldn't prune any roots.
Well, when you dig it, you're going to prune the roots anyway.
Just right. Kind of inadvertently.
And I don't think you'll have any issues sometimes when we dig trees out of the nursery, we do it with a machine, and so we'll have some sometimes long roots that you have to cut back because they're just too long. There's no reason to dig a hole, trench for it, that one root. But in your situation, you'll probably cut all the roots off when you dig it up. And, of course, the more roots you can leave, the larger the hole you go around it, the less shock it will have and faster it will come into bearing.
What about pruning then the above?
Yeah, I like doing that. After you've transplanted, you are going to be reducing the root surface. So if you cut back the top, maybe a quarter of the growth that's on the top from the this current season's growth, a fourth to a third, that will help balance the tree out with the reduced roots.
Did you say a quarter to a third of this year's growth?
Of the new growth, yeah.
So not a quarter of the tree.
That's right. Right. You wouldn't need to cut the tree back necessarily because you're just balancing. That would be more severe and not really necessary.
Okay. Can you make yourself do that, Janine?
Yeah, I can do that.
sometimes tough.
Those kind of cuts tend to then create branching effects, yes? No?
Yes.
And is that desirable?
Well, it depends upon the shape of the tree. Do you have some long branches that have grown out since you planted it?
Yes, and it has a fairly upright kind of habit to it, but good angles.
I think generally I like cutting them back and creating more branch surface. You get more fruiting area, and plus the plant is more balanced that way, too.
Okay.
You can always thin them out, thin the new shoots out.
Mm-hmm.
You get two or three coming from that cut. You can just leave one if you want.
All right. Well, thanks for the advice.
You bet.
Sure.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Good morning. Shall we take a... Was that Tim or?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we got somebody. Is that you, Tim?
Hear me there?
Yeah.
All right, good. Thank you.
Yeah.
I got some chocolate vine from One Green World about maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Chocolate vine, what's that, Jim? You're going to have to bring us all up here on to date. Chocolate vine, what's that, Jim?
Yeah, I'm trying to, is that Akebia? What was the...
I don't know the Latin name for it. But it grows prolifically on the fence, and it's supposed to have fragrant flowers and little pods that have a sticky, delicious substance inside.
It's funny.
And the plant has grown really well. It just about covers up half the neighbor's fence on my side, and it makes flowers, but I haven't seen any pods yet. And I'm wondering if I'm doing something wrong or if there's something else I'm supposed to do.
Well, this is wonderful. I hope this isn't a senior moment for me, but but I think that chocolate vine was probably, we may not have called it that name, but it is, I think commonly there's a name like that for Akebia. And probably, and that what you described sounds like Akebia, and that's my memory is, serves me right. That's what it is, Akebia quinata.
Would it have pods at some point?
Yeah, and so Akebia is a grows the way you just talked about, but it what it requires are two different varieties to make.
Which I have.
And you have those, and both of them are blooming.
Actually, they're also intertwined. Couldn't really.
Not sure.
I mean, it's likely.
Yeah. Well, they have different kinds of flowers, and so if you when it's blooming this spring, take a look at the color of the flowers. Primarily, that's how you can tell them apart.
Unfortunately, I'm blind. I'm a blind gardener.
Scent gardening is good.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll grab somebody and get them out there and have them tell me what color the flowers are.
That'll give you an idea then. If the flowers are identical, then probably you have two plants of the same variety, which wouldn't work for making the fruit.
Well, no, I know I have two plants of two different varieties.
You do, okay.
Well, mistakes have been known to have been made at the nursery before, so.
Oh, okay. That's
you know, it's unlikely, but. I hear horror stories all the time. And, well, this isn't the plant that I ordered. Not from One Green World, necessarily.
Of course not. But at any rate, that's been our experience. They generally will make the fruiting pods without any trouble. I mean, in fact, they make more of them than we really want sometimes. I mean, because they'll also, the seeds from those pods will make more seedlings that will come up at the base of the desired plants. But they're fairly prolific. There's something there that's typically bees work the flowers. So, I would get somebody to give you an idea of what the flower colors are. If there's any differences in them, that would be helpful.
I'll do that.
Either that or.
Do they ever need to be cut back or other than for aesthetic purposes?
Yeah, only for aesthetic purposes. They do grow pretty vigorously, and sometimes people get kind of shocked by it. They're semi-evergreen. I think they're quite attractive, and the flowers are nicely fragrant, too.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, this one's growing.
All right. Well, call us again.
Thank you
know,
very
let
much.
Us know.
Yeah, let us know about that.
You're right.
Yep,
see what you got. Okay, you bet. All right. That's it. Tammy says she just pulled out the phone jack.
I think that's
really.
Wonderful. I really that's. I thank you all, listeners, for calling in. I mean, that was.
Well, let's take a break here, Tammy. Let's go to the last tune there, Brian Auger. I'd rather to do that one. We just got to get our breath here. We'll come back with we'll just tell them what the garden stumper was, and this, maybe we'll give them a minute or two to answer that. But then we'll go for that. Okay, this is Brian Auger from his album Second Wind. There's the key here, Second Wind.
To be sure, you got every
Brian Auger, Truth. That has aged well. Okay, Jim. It's the Jim show today here. You have our garden stumper.
Yes.
And maybe the answer right away, too. We're running out of time here.
Right. So there's a really beautiful shrub that we have that blooms. I've given you some hints here. It blooms in the fall. Right now, it's in bloom. Fragrant, wonderfully fragrant, vanilla-like fragrance. I mean, I'm just so pleased to be around it. It blooms in the fall, and the fruit ripens in late spring.
Yeah.
It's evergreen. And it's a relative of a fairly large number of other shrubs. That also, another clue, I'm giving a lot here, it fixes nitrogen.
Boy, see, this sounds like a perfect plant.
It's pretty neat. And sadly, the problem with the fruit is that in our area, when we get so much cold sometimes, that some years the fruit won't survive to spring. But generally it does. And the bees work on it. Bees are working on it. So Glenn, for bees, man.
Yeah, cool. This is a good one.
It's a good one.
Okay.
And so that's our...
if anybody has an idea on this in the next 2 minutes, just give us a quick ring here, 503-231-8187.
And we could continue this on into the next show if we have to.
Well, Jim, that means we have to remember it.
I'll remember it.
Okay.
I got it written down.
I have it right here, too. All right, I'm just going to give you a little quick report on... what's going on in the bee colonies right now? Whew, they're hunkering down.
They're out there pollinating this plant.
Yes, when it gets warm enough, they will. In fact, at your place, they could have been out yesterday. I had some bees flying yesterday. Mm-hmm. Just a reminder, bees don't hibernate. So whenever it's warm enough, they're out there looking for pollen and nectar. And, well, actually, they don't eliminate inside the colony, too. So they hold it until they have a warm enough time that they can go out and take what we call a cleansing flight.
Winter recreation.
Well, maybe for some. And the queen has probably stopped laying eggs now. She takes about 2 months off from mid-October to mid-January. But the bees are trying to stay warm, and they can do that very easily by clustering and then generating heat the same way we do, shivering. They contract their muscles, their wing muscles, actually. And if we have enough critical mass of bees, then it's no problem at all to keep the colony warm. The hive will survive. But if something is affecting the number of bees, the cluster, then they don't have the critical mass. They can't keep the cold out. The question is, well, what is it that's causing the cluster to go smaller and smaller? Well, no doubt it's related to the varroa mite, a parasitic mite. But really, what I've learned to start calling it now is the varroa virus complex, because varroas can transmit many diseases. You know, not unlike an open wound in a plant where the fungal spores can get in there. When the varroa punctures the body of the bee, then it can inject these viruses. And that's what really weakens the colony there, too. So one other point of information to pass along here is that on the Oregon Public Broadcasting, Oregon Field Guide program, that the Oregon Field Guide crew followed my project, my queen breeding project, mine and Tim's, for a year. And it ended this fall, and the program is going to be on tomorrow night.
Wow.
So just a short segment of Oregon Field Guide, but you can see how this selective queen breeding, that's all about, if you're interested there.
That's great. Do you know what time that is?
8:30 is when the Oregon Field Guide is on, but yeah. I don't know when our segment will be on. Esteban suggested kiwi is the answer to the plant, Jim.
Nope,
that's not right.
It's a good guess, but it's a bush.
Okay, just tell us, Jim. You got 30 seconds.
Eleagnus abingii, known as silverberry.
And there's quite a few silverberries.
Well, there's quite a few Eleagnus.
I mean, excuse me. Well, there's what's called silverberry, because I've heard Eleagnus pungens also called silverberry. Yes. And they have kind of a silvery underside of the leaf.
That's right. And the fruit is speckled with silver specks.
Uh-huh. So there's many reasons.
That's particularly interesting and very attractive and related to gumi and autumn olive and Russian olive and other Eleagnus.
Right.
And even seaberry distantly.
Okay. That's it, Jim.
Okay,
we're out of time.
All right, new garden summer for next month. Then we won't carry
this
one over.
Obviously. That's right. Okay. Well, we'll probably have the bee edition next week or next month. Thanks for all the calls. Thanks for listening. Be well.
All right, that's it for public affairs programming here on KBOO this morning. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And we have the KBOO Dune News coming your way, and then Charlie Rooney's here with jazz. Thanks for tuning in today.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, November 12, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, an Oregon State University scientist has developed a drug that he believes can be used to treat the Ebola virus. In clinical trials of monkeys, the drug cured 60 to 80% of them, while all monkeys in the control group died. Zerpeta Therapeutics, the manufacturer, has received approval from the Food and Drug Administration to use it in the U.S. if needed. There are currently no plans to ship the new